Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, I'm Sarah Pascoe.
Hello, I'm Carrie Adloyd.
And we're weird about books.
We love to read.
We read too much.
We talk too much.
About the too much that we've read.
Which is why we've created
The Weirdos Book Club.
Join us!
A space for the lonely outsider to feel accepted and appreciated.
A place for the person who'd love to be in a real book club but doesn't like wine or nibbles.
Or being around other people.
Is that you? Join us.
Check out our Instagram at Sarah and Carrie Ads Weirdos Book Club for the upcoming books we're going to be discussing.
You can read along
and share your opinions.
Or just skulk around in your raincoat like the weirdo you are.
Thank you for reading with us. We like reading with you.
This week's guest is Death of a Bookseller by Alice Slater. What's it about? It's a book about selling books and reading true crime books, written by a writer who once sold books, but now she's writing about a bookseller writing poems, which are in fact bits of books.
And what qualifies it for the Weirdo Book Club? It's a page-turner about a weird woman and her obsession with a slightly less weird woman that she works with. In this episode, we will be discussing true crime.
Retail.
Class.
Bra fittings.
Grief.
Columbiners.
Male masturbation.
Female cruelty.
And tote bags.
And joining us this week, we have the incredible author, Eliza Clark.
Eliza's debut novel, Boy Parts, is critically acclaimed, award nominated, and had people shouting things like incendiary and morbidly brilliant at her in the street. I read her new novel, Penance, over the weekend, and I'll be shouting, "You're a genius," at her as soon as we've finished recording.
Describing herself, Eliza says, "I'm from Newcastle and working class. To publishers, I'm diverse."
But she says it in a Geordie accent.
Welcome, Eliza Clark, and Death of a Bookseller. So she feels at home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's definitely loads of weirdos in this book. I think anyone who drinks fruit cider is weird. Just going to put it out there.
I think it's sort of one of the things that I find really gross about Roach is just the amount of fruit cider.
Yeah.
It's like, can you imagine how your teeth would feel?
Oh. Sometimes in a book, someone drinks a drink you wouldn't have. Like, I've read a book where the character kept having Baileys and Coke, and I know that's impossible, but it was still aspirational to me. Like, even though I know you can't put Baileys in Coke,
that's
Coke
disgusting.
In Baileys. The sweetness of it, the creaminess, if the writer
would
maybe
curdle,
wants it.
Wouldn't it?
It does curdle, yeah. Yes. Mm. But the way the fruit cider was described always made me think, oh God, those nights being a student, those drinks.
What's the name for it? It used to be something that people used to ask for, something like
snake bite.
Snake bite, yeah.
That would... Until it became illegal.
Yeah, we weren't allowed to serve it.
It was a cocktail because they were like, this three ingredients. You can't do it in Wetherspoons.
Oh God, so disgusting.
Yeah.
So we should say it is mainly about two women. It's told from each chapter different. It's been Roach and Laura. Mm-hmm. Roach is our official weirdo. I think that's fair to say. Mm-hmm. Laura is... perhaps on first meeting, you wouldn't think she's a weirdo, but it becomes clear that there are, you said, slightly less weird. They're both as
she has
weird.
Outsider tendencies.
Yeah, she's hiding
she's
them
creative.
Better, I suppose.
Yeah.
She's more hiding in plain sight, whereas Roach is absolutely, definitely, as soon as you meet her, a definite outsider.
So something I read when I was that they're both unlikable characters. So what I was going to ask you two is, did you like them? And is it important to like characters mm-hmm. if you're spending a whole book with them? Like starting with Roach, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think I like Roach. I think I like Roach a bit more than Laura because Roach is quite like earnest and upfront. I think it's like who would you rather deal with on a day-to-day basis? It's obviously Laura.
But as in terms of who I'm spending time with, I think I'm a Roach fan.
The writer definitely wants us to sympathise with her.
With Roach?
Yes. Mm.
Yeah, I think she works backwards. Like, as in, like, when you meet them, you're like, oh, Roach is awful, Laura's fine. And then you start that crossover point where you're like, oh, actually, maybe Laura's a pain in the fucking ass and Roach actually has some qualities. Although I did think Roach is, this is jumping ahead, Roach keeps a snail. And there is a moment, a snail incident that happens with Laura, which Roach uses to justify quite a lot of stuff. I still think we've all accidentally stood on a snail. Obviously, it means a lot more to Roach. But yeah, you do... I thought that was very clever and good, the way that when you meet Laura, you're like, she seems perfectly reasonable. Why is Roach so horrible? And then halfway through the book, you're like, actually.
Well, Laura's mean.
Do you think she's mean?
I don't think she's kind.
That's interesting.
To Roach.
No, she isn't kind to Roach, agreed.
And Roach, it's one of those classic, she can't help it, so you sort of forgive them.
Personality
traits. It's very well justified.
It is, but that's what I thought was interesting. In Roach's head, she justifies it quite a lot of like, oh, if only Laura was nice to me, we could be friends, we could have all these moments. But there was that moment where I was like, Roach, that's mental. Like, her imagination of like, oh, we're going to like be girls getting ready together. It's like something that Laura has never given, ever. I think they're both as bad as each other, to be honest, in their fantasies. Like, so Laura has this fantasy about this guy, Eli, and she is completely deluded about Eli in the way that Roach is completely deluded about her. So they're both not very good at picking up the signs of other people.
When Roach watches Laura perform her poetry, Roach is so taken with her. And so, and it really is genuine. Like, she can't believe that people are letting her walk out of the room to go for a cigarette because she thinks she's going to be mobbed by literary agents and fans. She's so overwhelmed with positivity towards her work, and that response is so genuine that then Laura's rejection of that, I'm not saying it's as bad as treading on a snail, or that if you, you know, all of us perform, all of us create
work. I was
going
to say, like, as a performer, when somebody is too effusive about your work, there is something off about
it. They actually can't be too effusive, actually, yeah. And people are addicted to my comedy.
They are. It's help groups. But you know what I mean? I think that's what's strange about Roach's reaction, because it seems nice. I think I might be Team Laura.
I think when you put work out there, and especially when you're still at a venue, you're technically still at work. Like, you've done a book reading, someone comes up to you, and you know, it's about them, not you. Mm. I still think there's a duty of care or a duty of professionalism, which is making them feel okay about their reaction to your work, even if you don't particularly like it.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Have you ever had weird people after reading, Eliza?
I find, like, I feel like I'm so on best behavior because the idea of upsetting somebody who is, like, enthusiastic about my book is so profoundly mortifying to me. That the idea of like somebody being very sort of excited about something and then being kind of rude about it afterwards. But then at the same time, I can't physically set a boundary. I'm really, really bad at setting boundaries. So yes. I was thinking maybe Laura's just setting a boundary and that's valid.
I don't think like, a boundary person, I would think, would go, okay, you've had your time with me. Yeah. Here's your time with me. So nice to meet you. I'm going to go back to my friend
now. Yes, that's true. She's just kind of mean.
She makes her feel stupid.
You keep seeing both of them do things. You're like, just don't do that.
I know, that's what I think. If you
don't
were,
do that.
If you were Roach's friend.
Yeah, you'd be like, you say, back off a bit.
Or
and
come
also
back
you
now,
just be slightly polite.
Yeah, so go and buy her book, ask her to sign it. You know, there are...
Yeah.
But someone at that early stage in their career, they should just be grateful that someone says well done after their show.
Well, this is true because, Eliza, you're a very successful and brilliant writer. So
Thank you.
Talking about something of like a book has come out and caused this complete change in the narrative and culture and people come up to you. This is a small local poetry reading.
Yeah.
So you think Laura would be a bit more like, oh my God, somebody liked it. Yeah. She does act like she's Margaret Atwood. She's like, I don't have time. I have to go.
Margaret Atwood is always smoking, in the pub garden with the boy she fancies.
If you want to find Atwood, she's out having a rollie at the back of the two brothers.
Have you ever had people want to hug you?
No one has asked to touch me yet.
Because that's the boundary that I find really difficult, because they think of a hug as a gift for you. Like, here is my gift.
Yeah.
Here is my, I feel so connected, I feel like we can hug, but you've just met them.
And also you don't like hugging full stop.
I think a hug is a take. I think a hug is a little bit of take of energy.
Yeah.
A little,
That's how you treat a hug, definitely.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And so part of my boundary thing is to start to say no.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But it's a really then awkward thing because they then feel terrible because they were giving you a gift and you've gone, I don't want your disgusting gift.
Yeah, your reaction to hugs is quite visceral.
Yeah.
So I don't hug you. I've known you for 20 years.
I don't have a visceral reaction to strangers.
No, but you're not polite. But you're not a fan of them, even from people you know, is what I mean. So then when strangers ask, it's even more.
Yeah, it's a quandary.
It's a quandary.
It's a quandary.
I feel like that about photos.
Catherine Ryan, because I used to really feel bad. When I used to want to say no is when I had no makeup on and I was like, you know, on the tube, early morning, etc. And I'd want to say no, as in like, it's not going to be a nice photo. And Catherine Ryan said to me, it's really important other women see women who wear makeup at work looking normal. So you have to take ugly photos. So now I just do them.
She always looks good is the irony of that comment.
She has incredible porcelain skin and looks good in all of her photographs.
I've seen porcelain. I want to talk about, if we can, the true crime element of this.
Yes.
This is quite interesting for myself and Sarah. I do not like true crime. Mm. I hate it with a passion. I don't read it. I don't listen to it. Sarah is Team Roach.
This is why I'm so fascinated because I'm reading Penance at the moment, Eliza, and I can't pick you. You've obviously done a huge amount of research into true crime podcasts and fandom and the internet and Reddit threads, but I couldn't, with Alice Slater, the writer of this book, while there is a debate about the merits of true crime and how exploitative it is and how without empathy it can be as an entertainment format and whether we're comfortable with that, I still felt that, you know, at the beginning where she's going to see like the murder girls. Rachel's going to see murder girls, which feels to me so clearly my favourite murder.
I thought it was my favourite murder.
And I was like, she's a true crime fan. Who also, you know, we can be true crime fans and also have our doubts occasionally. But Eliza, I couldn't pick it with you.
I guess I'm sort of a little bit of both in that I feel like I'm a bit of a convert in that I've converted to not liking it much. And that I used to listen to a lot of true crime podcasts and sort of just kind of indulge in it quite a lot. I will say in my defense, I did always think of it as a prurient and rubbernecking interest. I was never kind of like, it's feminist actually. It was kind of as I was writing Penance, I sort of went off it. I did a lot of like reading of like true crime books, like big books written by sort of, I mean, I guess there's always going to be a degree of exploitation, but I guess journalists who I feel were making a genuine effort not to be exploitative and to give you kind of like a socio-political history, I think, of a crime is always really interesting and really important to hear. So it's kind of like reading sort of high quality stuff like that and then kind of thinking about it a lot while I was writing Penance and then going back to a podcast. I just remember like listening to like half an hour of one and just turning it off and thinking, this is vile. I don't think I can do this anymore.
It is very strange, the comedy genre overlap. Mm. So in Penance, there is Coots is called one of the guys.
Yeah.
And it's really like one of the American podcasts, which is called
Last
Podcast on the Left.
Oh, okay.
And essentially they do funny voices and they improv and they talk over each other. And
about true crime?
Yeah. Not saying I don't like listening to men.
Yeah.
I feel like I can listen to men.
Yeah, you can, yeah.
But when I listen to Last Podcast on the Left, I feel like those people who write underneath, unbearable. The pitch of their voices, it's so grating.
Yeah.
Because they are trying to make each other laugh. So that comedy, the flippancy of comedy, which is so psychopathic in itself, like it is so devoid of empathy.
Well, yeah, I do a podcast called Griefcast. Mm-hmm. That's obviously why I'm Team Laura, because it's like I can relate to having lost a parent at a young age and talking about grief. And people in, what I found interesting, people in the grief community, and there is a grief community industry as much as there's true crime, do not like, there's not a crossover that we do not meet. Because it's like, as soon as I started reading Laura, I was like, I didn't see her always as mean. I was like, this person has so much grief and they haven't dealt with it.
Yeah.
So she's angry and she's blocked off and she's defensive. And it's like all of a sudden is grief, undealt with grief, which I actually think Alice did a really good job of writing someone who is grieving in a way that doesn't look like grief, that everyone else is like, oh, she's a stuck up bitch. And it's like, there's just so much pain in that person. And everything she's doing is pretend, it's fake. It's like, I'm just trying to put myself back together because I don't know who I am. We've had this conversation about true crime, like anything that seems like to listen to it by choice when you don't need to feel that. It's like, why would you do that when it, like, grief is out there, pain is out there. Why would you then go and like open the door? But we've had this conversation where you're like, but it feels like safer to listen to it. Well, I'm like, it feels terrifying to listen to.
People's defensiveness of it is usually people who maybe, and I obviously can't speak for everyone, who could consider themselves traumatized or anxious, but not having experienced great grief.
Yeah,
because
they
say that's why it calms me. They go, because really,
I found that really weird when she was talking about the calm. I listened to the Westbridge 3 or whatever it was, and I felt my jaw unclenched, and I was like, I cannot imagine it. Listening to something that's horrific and it relaxing you.
Yeah.
Whereas my grief community, it's like you listen to the person talking about their grief and that's what relaxes you, because you're like, oh, you went through this thing. But you're not talking about, I don't know, it's not like you're not investigating the trauma in that way. You're investigating the trauma from someone kind of after the event, talking, they're in control in a much clearer way.
The other very ethical thing is the advertising. Do you get it? Something that you talk about in Penance in terms of like selling mattresses.
Oh my god.
But there are some people who want to tell stories around true crime but don't think it's appropriate to make your living off it.
It's the same come up in grief podcasts. Like, I do adverts for the show so that it exists, and then sometimes what happens is they'll run automatic adverts, so I get people going, my listeners will email me and go, do you realize there's a Father's Day advert for a supermarket?
Ooh.
And you're like, no. Or like a baby one, and you've had an episode about child loss and you're like, oh god, like it was advertising like a nappy deal or something.
This episode has got fat pills. It's just calling everyone a fat bitch, saying take these pills. Yeah, it's Khloe Kardashian.
God. And it is hard, because that's the and I think Alice dealt with that very well. I felt like it was a very balanced view of true crime, in that you did get Laura's slightly pious opinion, and then I did appreciate hearing the other side of Roach talking about, you know, what it meant to her and how it felt to be part of that community. And but yeah, I still found myself a bit shocked that she entered it, when she was like, oh, I entered it through being a Columbiner, of like people who used to like follow the Columbine shooters and were like really into them. I was like, what? Where is this world?
Well, one of the characters in Penance is very similarly, and I actually hadn't realised this was a thing, but of course it is.
Yeah.
A young woman who identifies with a school shooter, and you know, they have nicknames for them and want to communicate with them and read their diaries and so overly romanticise them as heroes and identify with them because they live in a shithole. You know, that horrible teenage feeling they project onto them and go, they like me, they didn't fit in. No one appreciated them. They lived in a shithole.
For me, it sort of feels like a bit of a misfire of empathy.
Yeah.
And that they're empathizing with the wrong people, but it's sort of like almost the kind of like, I don't know, this very extreme act of empathizing with someone, of empathizing with somebody who's done something so, so awful. And that, I think, I don't know, I just feel like teenagers have got a lot of weird, very strong misfiring emotions constantly. And it's like, it's just gone to completely the wrong person. There's a really fantastic book called Savage Appetites by a writer called Rachel Monroe. She sort of details four different cases of true crime fans. So it's like the first one is like an older lady in the 50s in America who makes these like very intricate little maquettes. But then I think it's the last chapter is about Columbiners. And it's just a very interesting exploration of, I don't know, I guess women who are really, really into murder in different ways, from these little sort of intricate maquettes to, she has this great anecdote where she's talking about this young woman who gets obsessed with like a bank robber in her local town. I can't remember if he's a bank robber or he kidnaps a kid or if he does both. And she writes this like half of a novel that's very romantic and very, very sort of invested in this kind of dark hero. And then the fantastic punchline at the end was like, and that woman was Ayn Rand. it's a great punchline, but it's also just everything you need to know about Ayn Rand in a nutshell, isn't it? The OG serial killer fangirl.
There's a really interesting evolutionary theory, and obviously that's not hard science, but because it doesn't make sense to most people.
Yeah.
Why? But the evolutionary theory is that if there is a dangerous man around, your safest place is to befriend him or to be near him. The idea that the reason human beings are all so different is that we sort of fit together in a tribe, you know, in terms of survival senses. There's just this way that we feel is an aberration, but actually it's another way of being safe, which is like, no, I'm his girlfriend.
Yeah.
I won't be one of his victims.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I thought she did really well for me, coming from grief camp, is she caught the idea that there was a piece of this puzzle that Roach didn't fucking get,
yeah,
and a piece that Laura did get. And even though Laura is a bitch and is annoying and could have been kinder, she does have this, like, her mum was murdered.
Yes.
And that Roach, the way Roach dances around all of this stuff is so fantastical and isn't based in any reality. And I feel like Laura lives in a really horrible reality, and it's like Roach is living in podcast internet world.
Oh, absolutely. If you said to someone, oh my God, I'm so into that serial killer,
yeah,
and they said that person killed a relative of mine,
yeah,
you instantly would feel so, oh God. Whereas Roach's reaction is, ooh, which
I
one?
Know.
And I thought, why has she been so secretive?
That was such a nice thing in the book, that Laura would be mean in her head about Roach and be like, oh, I can see her like waiting for crumbs like a dog. Mm. And then you'd hear Roach being like, oh God, I was so excited. And you're like, oh, Laura's not wrong about Roach.
Yes.
So that's what I thought was interesting. Her meanness and her distaste of Roach comes from a truth of like, you find me interesting for the wrong reasons. Mm. But the way Laura dealt with that wasn't always helpful. But there was an absolute truth that Roach was interested in her like a car crash. Mm. And that Laura's had that all her life. And as a grieving person who's had like extremely traumatic grief, she's been dealing with that since a teenager. So you can see she's run out of patience. So when she does come across Roach, she's like, fuck you. I have no time for these people who I can feel as like leeching on me.
Roach considers it to be open territory, as if she considers her interest in a murderer who is local to her to be partly owned.
I know, that's it. What do we feel about that? Of like, who does own that story? Because I thought that was really interesting, of like, Roach does have a point. It's a public story. She grew up around it.
People's lives are sometimes hugely affected by local crime. I mean, there was a girl who went missing where I grew up from a playground that we played in.
God.
And what happens is a generation of children know that name, are told that story, it's repeated up until your teens. So the huge emotional effect isn't, the lovely phrase you used, Eliza, was like empathy misfiring.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't think you have the same ownership as the family of that person, but it was oddly a story that was told to you again and again throughout your life and feels like part of the fabric of your story as well.
Yeah, it's complicated. I think that's what I liked this book, I thought did very well, of not drawing a line in the sand, of being like, oh, that's right, that's wrong. Like, and because she keeps flicking between Laura and Roach, you're constantly, and I, look, totally, there was times, as a former goth, I was on Roach's side. There was definitely times when I was like, yeah, fair play. I got a bit annoyed with Laura for not realising Roach was in her house.
Did you? Do you think you'd just know if someone was in your house?
I got a bit like, oh, I guess it's good writing, isn't it? I was frustrated. I like desperately wanted the moment where she discovered her, like, and that the way it's always so hazy, everything's hazy, which I thought was interesting because it comes back to like Laura's mother's murder, everything being a bit hazy, and it's actually quite hard to pin things down. But like the boring narrative person in me was like, I want you to know and to tell her. The bit when she's, there's a bit with, spoiler, it's all a spoiler, when she just finds out she's in the bathroom and you're like, it's not even like, it's just because she's singing that she hasn't heard. And Mochi's like, oh, whoa, that was a close one. You're like, why did you go back there? There were some lovely details. I appreciated Roach sniffily going through her wardrobe and discovering it's all H&M, ASOS and Atmosphere. Well, she thought it was more vintage. And it's like, no, she just dresses from the high street. Like, but Roach is so out of fashion, she has no idea. Mm. Also found it stressful when she was bleaching her hair without sort of consulting the box. That was very stressful. Like, that's not something you should do by yourself while drinking fruit cider.
But as a character trait, that's absolutely it was great. Dead on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was perfect. It was perfect.
So, working in a bookshop.
Yeah, we got some...
Have you got a fact?
Well, I got some facts. Okay. Just that she is a former bookseller, Alice Sater. She worked in Waterstones. So the book company in the podcast is called Spines, which is clearly Waterstones. Yeah. She started as a Christmas temp. Then, Sarah Pascoe, I've got a fact. It's going to blow your mind.
Oh, my gosh.
Sarah, where did you work? I'm a bookseller.
I worked in W.H. Smith's in Romford.
Alice Sater was a manager of Romford Waterstones.
I didn't even know there was a Waterstones in Romford. So it definitely wasn't back then. Okay. But it does say that at the back of the book.
Oh, no, so I thought you were excited.
No, it was still exciting because I was just thinking about the people of Romford and have they become more literary.
Was it just W.H. Smith when you were there?
Yes, and also the W.H. Smith was mainly magazines.
Oh, yeah.
We didn't have a large book section. But at the time, just in our defence, we weren't reading books because Born Slippy came out and it had Going Back to Romford as the last line. Yeah. So we were just dancing to that.
Oh, great.
We were too busy to read.
Too busy to read.
Yeah.
I was also a former bookseller of W.H. Smith's. Not the Romford branch. We should say Alice Sater then moved up to the Gower Street branch, then Notting Hill Gate.
Gower Street's a great branch.
Yeah, and she moved up well. She's a good book, clearly a very good bookseller.
When was the last one?
Notting Hill Gate.
And then she became a very, very successful author. Yeah. So that's the ladder.
That's the ladder you got to take, booksellers.
Eliza, did you ever work in a bookshop?
No, I didn't. My best customer service job was I worked at Agent Provocateur for not quite a year.
Oh, so that is
Did you
good.
Have to measure bras?
I did a lot of bra fitting. I used to see like 6 to 7 pairs of boobs a week. And then I sort of moved back to Newcastle and became a bartender. It's no boobs at all. it was a huge loss.
So the world of a bookshop, the sort of the retail elements of it are very, very well observed in the book.
The retail elements are so good. She really does get the like
Christmas customers.
Mm. And the list of questions she has of what people can ask. You can almost feel Alice Slater's own personal anger bristling through.
There are some really funny jokes about very recent successful books as well.
Yes,
in terms of, oh my God, you haven't read this. Or, this is what you're going to love.
And I thought Roach was really good at judging Laura's pathetic book pride on things and the way that she would sell them to certain people and the way they look. And the tote bag trolling. There's some excellent tote bag trolling of saying like, oh, it's in typewriter font and it says bookworm, or though she be but little, she is fierce, which is a quote I once had on a badge, to be fair, in my 20s, which was a long time ago. But yeah, I was like, oh gosh, she really like slams those kind of people who see books as a personality. Which I think is...
This podcast.
I was like,
it's us. And our new tote bags. Carriage, you've not seen them yet. It's your little face on a tiny puppy.
It says, so she be little, she is fierce.
Yeah.
In typewriter font that no one uses anymore.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the Tumblr generation that I come from, which I'd happily see back. I thought the retail stuff was really impressive, really good. And I thought that's what made Roach quite likeable for me, is that Roach kept skewering Laura's perfection of that. And I guess that's the type of personality perhaps we're familiar of books being, I'm a good person because I know books. Like, therefore, I'm smart and I'm kind and I'm funny and I'm interesting.
And also, but when you work in retail, you get paid very little. You get paid minimum wage, maybe slightly higher, but you are expected to be devoted. And they have a star system in this bookshop.
Yeah.
And Roach doesn't want to join in on that. And I think there is a division in retail of those who just, you know, this is where I work. I do what I'm told from head office, and people who see through it.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you remember, was it Otterkers you had next door? There was another bookshop.
There was a better bookshop.
Your manager described it. Do you remember?
No, he said a lot of mad things to my manager.
Okay, so this is my memory.
Okay.
You coming home one day, not furious, but maybe just contempt.
It was hard work.
Because the manager had been describing the lead up to Christmas as being like the Somme.
No, yes, I was going to say this. This is what happened was, so there was another bookstore, a Waterstones-esque cool bookstore, W.H. Smith's. Let me tell you, as my manager once told me, sells most books in the UK, so I don't know why people are so sniffy about it. And he took us all off the shop floor into a corridor, like outside of the shop. So like left books, no one was there. It was Christmas. And like, this is like four uni grads, all like English students, you know, being like, we don't really know what we're doing. We're just here. All of us are waiting for our lives to begin. And he was like, this is Christmas. You, I cannot believe the way you're selling. This is the trenches. This is the Somme. This is World War One. You got your backpacks on, machete in hand. We're going over the top. And we just all stared at him like, this isn't happening. And it was like after the office had been out. So, you know, like this, yeah. How the office has ruined speeches like this. You should now be ashamed of yourself for making that speech. And I said, are you serious? He was like, yes, I am. Now go back out there, soldiers, and sell, sell, sell.
A lot of the narrative of this book is two women not being very kind to each other. Mm-hmm. The characters in Penance are younger, so they're still at school, and it goes all the way back to primary school. And it does, like, having read both of them in quick succession, I'm like, oh God, women are awful to each other. Girls are so cruel. Everyone's a bully. Everyone is bullied and a bully at the same time.
Yeah.
And so you can't really pick who is the worst. And
yeah.
Do you hate women?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. You've been listening to Weirdos Book Club.
See you later. I often think boys get off the hook with how cruel they are to each other. Mm. There was, I'm going to tell a gross anecdote, but there was a boy at my school who didn't know what wanking was. And then the other boys told him that it was when you put your fingers up your bum.
Oh, no.
And then he told them that he did it and that he got some substances on his fingers, and they just called him Brown Finger for the rest of the time. They used to sing it to the tune of Goldfinger.
So bad.
And it's like, but girls would never do that.
Maybe they would, actually. I think it's very different cruelty, and maybe as women, we can, but we know what female cruelty really feels like. So when you're reading it, perhaps it feels, whereas boy, if you told that story to another boy who'd been bullied, they might be like weeping now in PTSD. Whereas we're like, oh, they called him Brown Finger. Good song reference.
Yeah.
So I think there's
great joke.
Yeah. There's a particular, because it's like,
it's familiar.
It's that familiar pain that you know that got, like, the cruelty that women have. And I think it comes
also,
back to, like,
the unescapableness of it, especially in Penance, because they're online. And I guess for these characters, for Laura and Roach, you're stuck working with someone.
Yeah.
It's that thing of hating going in, being fearful of, are they in the room? What mood are they in? Oh, are they on their lunch break too? I guess what feels familiar is the unescapable nature.
Yeah,
of it.
And I think it's also what she deals with really nicely is the hidden nature of female cruelty, because we don't tend to get into, like, brawling. That's not how problems are solved. It's all done underhand. So that Roach and Laura are both horrible to each other, and everyone in the staff room is like, oh, come on, like, just have a fag, calm down. Like, it's like this, the insidious nature that it's played out in that. And both times, there's times when you feel for Roach and Laura because it's something so unfair has happened. And like when, you know, the example, I guess, when Roach steals her poem and it's just like absolutely blazing, it wasn't me. And everybody kind of, they both feel like they haven't been treated fairly, even though all everyone's tried to do is stay out of it. Mm. Everyone's just trying to basically, like, not have anything to do with it. But yeah, that female bitchiness, I suppose, is the classic word for it.
It's very, like, claustrophobic, I think. Yeah, feeling.
But
I think,
also, you hope that we grow out of it.
Mm.
Do you think we do?
Mm. I have.
I think, like, by the time you're in your... I think most people do, particularly by the time they're at least in their 30s.
Yeah.
Hopefully. But I think sometimes work really brings out the, like, high school in people.
Yeah,
because it can be so, like... Because you're kind of forced to be there. Like school.
Yeah.
And there is that kind of, like, I don't know, especially when there's, like, a sort of in-group, out-group element to it. I think that can get very, like, yeah, like you said, very claustrophobic, that feeling of coming in and being like, is this person here today? Oh, thank God they're off. Yeah. That kind of thing.
You're right. You're absolutely right about workplace. And it happens a lot, actually, in productions and plays. Everyone bonds over a dislike of one person. And that can be very subtle, but they are ostracized and they do know it. So they're, social elements, you know, last to be invited, people not including them in rounds. They're really subtle ways, but you know if you're that person.
What do they say? You need those things to say, we went to uni together, of like, if you don't know who everyone's moaning about, it's you. Like, if you're not in on that conversation, like, oh, I can't believe they did that, it's because it's you.
Yeah.
And it's like, I remember someone at uni saying that to me, and it was them. I was like, oh, do I have to start? Yeah, God, isn't she annoying? Like, I had to give you something so you feel like you're in the, but actually we are all moaning about you at the moment. I think it comes from school life, and that's why school life, I think my parents are obsessed with schools, because if you have a good school and your experience of school can be like, yes, there was bullying, but I was looked after, or I learned to survive it. Then when you get to a workplace, you can recreate that. And if you feel like people are being mean to you, you can be like, well, that's their problem, not mine, I'm okay. But if you were in school, like Roach clearly was, it never got dealt with, her mum didn't support her, she's alone, you continue it and you're looking for those patterns again. You're just recreating it. And her thing with Laura, like, she does obsess over her as soon as she meets her, and she is creepy about her dead mother who was murdered. Like, there's lots of things on paper where you're like, yeah, you can see why people don't instantly want to hang out with you. And the only way she survives it is to basically remodel herself entirely on Laura. She sort of steals Laura's life, which I really like that, because it felt weirdly like Sweet Valley High to me. Do you know what I mean? It was like a real teenagey, like, I'm going to steal. She gets her hair, she gets her clothes, like, she literally takes away everything. But I sort of, yeah, I was hoping for a big, not Sweet Valley High, maybe like Hollyoaks, like, moment where, like, she, like, threw a drink over her. But you don't quite get that moment, which I think is probably better writing than Hollyoaks.
With that school choices thing, so Carad and I are at an age where people...
We're just at an age. That's the phrase. We're at an age.
We're at an age now where the schools thing is a really huge decision, and people want their children to have... to avoid the life they had.
Yeah,
so if you're unhappy at a comprehensive, you think by spending money...
they'll be fine,
or selecting a better school. But I don't think there is any school, because in Penance, there's a mixture of sort of upper middle class, wealthy children, but at a comprehensive. And then, you know, there's a couple of housing estates of differing sizes, and the level of care at the school, which actually isn't really poor, but is it something that you've thought about a lot in terms of your own schooling or background?
Yeah, I went to a school quite similar to the one that I sort of talk about in Penance. So there's, I'm from the West End of Newcastle, where there's like a huge comprehensive called Warbottle, which is like, I think it's like nearly like 2,000 students or something. It's like massive. And then also, when I started school, Newcastle was in 3-tier, and it changed to 2-tier around the time that I would have been going to 2-tier. My mom also went to Warbottle and was having like a nervous breakdown about the idea of sending me specifically to Warbottle when I was 11, because I would have died there, because I was a very strange child. there was a comprehensive in Ponteland, which is like a village in sort of the bottom end of Northumberland, where it's like right on the border between Northumberland and Tyne and Wear. So I got sent to a middle school and a high school in Northumberland. And it was kind of very like that, where there was a mix of like kids that had been busted from the West End by parents that were sort of a bit like, you're not going to Warbottle. And then like kids that were from the area of Ponteland. But then there were like estates around the Ponteland area as well. But there was also Darris Hall, which is like where the footballers live. And it was where all of the new money kids lived. So it was a real mix of just like a really broad mix of sort of socioeconomic backgrounds that the kids were coming from.
Yeah, and that's something that, I mean, adults struggle with it, so of course teenagers struggle with.
They're just,
and it's
insane.
Such an easy way to victimize someone, isn't it? Like not having the right clothes, the right shoes, the way that very young people feel they have to display money for safety at school.
Well, Nelson, it's just so much like what both of these characters are doing is using these things to pretend they are someone. Like it's costume, it's drag. It's just like, I'm putting it on, and that's like Laura's tattoos and her vintageness and her matching berets and shoes is all saying, I'm fine. I'm not a person whose mum was murdered. I'm a normal person. And it's so funny that Rachel always calls her a normie, and you're like, yeah, I think Laura's desperate to be normal, because she's actually so weird compared to Roach. Her background is actually extreme, really extreme. And Roach is putting on, you know, like Roach is just trying anything. I think Roach doesn't have a clue, because she moved so quickly from heavy metal rocker to like vintage trying to be Laura.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we all are. You do at school, and that's what I guess these characters are slightly stunted, aren't they? Because they've both been they, you know, Roach for her own reasons, Dora for her own reasons, haven't got to that moment where you're like, oh, this is who I am, and that's fine. And that's when I think you can stop bullying or being bullied, because you're like,
yeah,
that's who I am. I can't really change it, can I? Like, that's just it.
Well, and that's who I am, and that person doesn't like it, which is fine.
It's just fine.
Yeah. And you learn that with stand-up comedy, actually, because at the beginning you really want everyone to laugh at you. God, this sounds like such a failed comic. And and then what you realise over many years... if anyone laughs, that's a win. It was at Soho Theatre. They were getting creatives together to talk, and I was talking to a chef, and it was actually so similar to comedy, which is like, you make the best dinner you can, and then someone will taste it and go, I don't like it, and it's not because you cooked a bad dinner.
Because some people have bad taste buds. Like, fundamental.
Well, not bad. Just not bad.
No, some people do. Come on, let's be honest. Some people do.
Some people just don't want what you're cooking.
Yeah, that's true. There's some people just don't want you.
And that's it. So if you're an accomplished chef, in this analogy, but it's your personality, you go, I'm doing my best. I'm doing my best with my personality. It's not for them.
Is that what Rach wanted to say at the end? I'm doing my best.
That is the ending.
That is the ending.
Ever fancied someone you work with?
I don't think so.
It's time to shout out. We might get snug. I love fancying someone at work because it's just a reason to go in.
Yeah, a reason to get excited.
Yeah, I was going to say, not seriously, only in a way to like entertain myself when I've been. It's sort of in a kind of like, could I fancy this?
But and then you usually make yourself fancy them, don't you? Because they're there.
And then you see them outside of work and you're like, nah.
Yeah.
Idiot, actually.
Carry on.
I can't discuss it. No comment.
No comment. She married him.
Yeah.
Christmas parties, works, drinks.
Oh, yeah, the work Christmas party they describe. That obviously is a Waterstones genuine Christmas party where they all go and get absolutely wasted.
I want to go to that, then.
It's our same. I thought it sounded really good. Maybe they'll invite us.
I would love a part-time job in Waterstones
You'd be good at it as well.
Because you would just get to hear from so many people about what they were reading and what you could read. And that's just a never-ending, brilliant conversation.
But I think you could just stand in Waterstones, because don't you remember the cashing up bit and all that and the stock? That's not as fun as the talking to people.
I'm there optionally.
Oh, okay. You're so like
I'm volunteering.
Those are the worst people at work, when you're like, you're slogging your guts off and you're like, no, I just turn up because I like it.
You know, like there's a kind of policeman that isn't really a policeman. They
community
just
support
police officer. I'm community support Waterstones.
I would like to add that I don't think that community supports the police officers. I don't think you're not real policemen. I think they get a bit offended.
Well, you guess what it was. So who's getting the hate mail?
Definitely still not me.
It's a really great book.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. And I am someone who does not like reading tense things, stressful things, because that's my life is being quite stressful. And I enjoyed it. And I had to read it while my kids were watching Andy and the Band on CBeebies. And I still managed to stay very tense and involved, which is pretty good, because Andy and the Band is a very good show.
Yeah, I get annoyed when books are really gripping.
Yeah.
I'm annoyed with Penance at the moment. I'm sorry, Eliza, because my son doesn't sleep very well, so I get very little sleep. And I was up till midnight last night reading Penance. And with this book, I read it over a couple of days. And I'm like, don't make yourself unputdownable.
Yeah, it was
I need
really
to start
stressful.
Reading the blurbs at the back of books and going, unputdownable. Not for me, then. I need putdownable, half a page and
you're asleep. An all-consuming thriller? No thanks. Yeah, they were like, tea's ready. And I was like, I'm just coming. And I had to like read the two epilogues, like pretending
very,
I was doing
very, very good setting up for the next stage of the story.
I wondered that. I was like, is there going to be another one? Or is
must
there,
be.
Do you think?
Yes.
I almost wondered if it
well,
needed
I guess
it.
You can leave it elusively, but either way, lovely cliffhanger.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh yeah, very good. We shouldn't spoil that. It was just like...
We haven't actually.
It was, no, I know. It was tasty.
I'm really proud of us.
Yeah, we haven't done any spoilers.
Well done.
Thank you.
We sometimes end with a quote. Do we have anything?
I looked for quotes and they were all either spoilers or too dark.
Should I just choose a random quote to say goodbye?
Okay, Eliza, give us a page number.
Yeah, and we'll just...
Sorry, it's my head going, don't say 69, don't say
69. No, say 69.
69.
Yeah, okay, so this is a non-sequitur.
You're non-sequitur.
And it's 10 lines down, please.
Okay.
Ooh. Would my weapon of choice be my phone to call for help, our biggest kitchen knife in an act of vigilante justice, or my silence?
That's a good taste of this book, isn't it? That's like, that's why I was
intriguing.
Like, ooh, intriguing.
Great, well done.
Thank you so much, Eliza,
Thank
for joining
you so
us
much,
to talk
Eliza.
About Death of a Bookseller by Alice Slater.
Thank you for listening to the Weirdos Book Club.
You can find out more about Eliza Clark's work if you head to elizaclarkauthor.com, or she's on Twitter at Fancy Eliza, and her incredible new novel Penance is also out to buy now. Death of a Bookseller by Alice Slater is also available in bookshops, would you believe it?
Sarah's first novel, Weirdo, is also available to buy now. Go and get it. It's out and it's brilliant and exciting, as is my book, You Are Not Alone. And if you want to do your homework early, the next week's book guest will be Under the Net by Iris Murdoch.
Thank you for reading with us.
We like reading with you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Lucy Beaumont.
And guess what? I'm Sam Campbell.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, you might enjoy our podcast. It's called Lucy and Sam's Perfect Brains.
We have a podcast and it might be, I probably don't want to sound, like I'm bragging, but it's dynamite. It is electric. It's high voltage. And please, we really need you to listen. You don't understand how much we need this.
Is it on all the platforms?
Oh, it absolutely is. But this one's out now. Lucy and Sam's Perfect Brains.